This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Jana Mendez is the former chief of disguise at the Central Intelligence Agency. Jana was a technical operations officer working in some of the world's most dangerous places. She joins us today to talk about her new memoir, In True Face, A Woman's Life in CIA Unmasked. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Micah Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io. Jana, welcome. Welcome back to Intelligence Matters. You were on the show before. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on your memoir, In True Face, A Woman's Life in CIA Unmasked. Congratulations. It's fantastic.
Well, it took a while to get it out, but I'm so glad to be able to present it soon.
Well, that's my first question. You retired, I think, in the early 1990s, right? 1993.
That's correct,
to be exact. Why 21 years later a memoir? Why not sooner? And I ask that in the sense that I know people have been waiting for you to write a memoir.
That's so interesting. You know, when I retired, Tony had already retired, and we both thought that we had, you know, had reasonable careers and we could put that down and move on. And it turns out that our moving on, both of us, led us back into the intelligence community. First, by teaching. David Major had a CI center. We did some extensive training that had been outsourced by the CIA to private hands. And then Keith Melton wandered in and said, you know, we're going to build a museum in downtown Washington. That was the International Spy Museum. We were only too happy to be part of that. Then Tony was named a trailblazer, brought a lot of attention. He ended up writing his first book based on that.
And just so people know, Tony was your husband.
Yes, he was.
Yes, yes.
And we lost him some few years ago, and
yes,
he's still very much in this house, but he left a big footprint.
Yeah, he sure did.
And we had written a series of books, and we wrote them together as his Parkinson's progressed. And then after he was gone, then there was COVID, and I was just here alone.
Yeah, what do you do during COVID?
I did a lot of jigsaw puzzles.
And maybe write a book too.
And I decided I'll just make some notes just, you know, before my memory starts fading away. And that was the beginning of the book because of COVID.
Mm. Well, it's outstanding. It really is. I had a really hard time putting it down. I would encourage all of my listeners to buy it, to read it, to enjoy it, to learn from it. It is extraordinarily well done. So congratulations again.
Thank you. It was a joy to do it.
Yeah. So we all have stories about how we ended up at CIA. Jana, what's yours?
The short answer would be that I kind of wandered in a side door. I did not go through the typical sending in of applications and interviewing process. I was hired overseas in Europe as the wife of a CIA officer. And as a wife, I was eligible to do some small jobs at the station. And there was a category called contract wife. It was women working for the CIA overseas, not in staff positions, But I didn't realize at the time that that was going to be a door that led me to a career. I was just looking to stay busy, make a little pocket money and see Europe.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting they called it contract wife, right? We're going to come back to the whole issue of gender and gender discrimination at the agency. But interesting that they called it contract wife and not contract spouse.
You know, years later, the odd man I know of two who accompanied their staff female wives overseas, they got the wonderful appellation of house husband.
House husband, yeah.
It's maybe even worse.
Maybe even worse. Jana, there are a number of distinct themes in the book, some directly stated by you, some less directly stated. And what I want to do is ask you about those themes and get you to talk about them a little bit. The first one, which is absolutely crystal clear throughout the entire book, is the immense love that you had for your work at every stage of your career, you know, the strong sense of community that you felt to the agency and to the mission. Can you talk about that theme?
You're right. From the beginning, the work to me was special. I spent the first few years I was working understanding the apparatus of the CIA, how it works, how the intelligence flows through it, what the operations people did, what the technical people did, all the various pieces of it. When we came back to the States, I worked in the Office of Technical Service. It was three blocks from my house. I was basically putting my husband through George Washington University, and it was just the whole thing. It was like something out of you would make it up. Let's see, I can walk home for lunch. My husband's in school. While I was working for OTS, now I was staff because we're back in the States. I did go through the process to get hired, just like everyone else. Working for the Office of Technical Service, I was working with a group of engineers. They were electrical and mechanical engineers. They were all very technical people, and they were doing outside contracts with private industry, and I was doing all the paperwork. And so I learned, you know, how you run a project, how you organize it, how you budget for it, how that process works. By the way, I also learned that engineers, not to make too broad a claim here, but they can't write. And so...
no comment on my part.
So I suggested to the ones that were having the biggest problems, I said, you know, instead of writing it, you could just sit here next to me and just dictate it. And that's what we did. And they got kudos in their fitness reports that I typed up saying how their reporting had improved. So I learned a lot of things in that systems branch, but that was not where my heart was. That was the entry point back in Washington, D.C. And then as a secretary, you were limited where your assignments were, but in that office, there was a top secretarial job. It was a GS-9. And so that became my target. And I ended up in that job. Didn't take that long to get there. And then I was stuck. Then I was truly stuck. There was nowhere to go.
We'll come back to that. Okay, I want to come back to that whole theme because that's a different theme.
Yeah.
But I think it's to stay on the first theme a little bit. I think it's hard for people who haven't had the experience of working there to understand really how much the people who work there love the work, because of the sense of mission, the importance of the mission, and how interesting the work is day to day. You literally pinch yourself, right, to say, am I lucky enough to be doing this?
Over and over, I did that, that pinching piece. The work was critical. We were providing technical support to the case officers who were the feet on the ground around the world. Yeah. And they would come in and say, could you build one of these? I have an operation. I need something like this. I can't find it commercially, and that's typically because it didn't exist. And we would get our engineers, our office, we were chemists, we were physicists, we had all kinds of technical skills. And if they actually needed a piece of equipment that was unique, we would build them one.
Yeah, you would get it for them.
So it was supporting the case officers, who to me were the heroes. They were the ones doing the hardest job I could imagine, which was getting people to give us the information that we wanted. And part of what we were doing was protecting everybody with this equipment, protecting the case officer, protecting the foreign source that was providing the information. You could just see, it was just a big wheel that was turning. I loved being part of that.
You know, another strong theme in the book, Jana, and this one is not explicitly called out, but it's the sense of adventure that one gets from serving overseas. With the CIA, in particular, the sense of belonging to a team that you're working with overseas, this sense of family overseas, you're smiling a little bit here, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think everybody serving at headquarters feels this way too, but it's particularly strong overseas, yes?
It absolutely is. And that's, I think, what was propelling me all along. I wanted to be a part of that. I never really aspired to run anything. I simply wanted to be part of the operational element that allowed us to bring this information home and get it back to our policymakers and let them make the decisions that needed to be made. I loved being part of a team, and it always felt like you were part of a team.
You know, you tell a couple of stories that I think are fit right into this sense of adventure overseas, and hopefully you can tell them to us here. One was lying on a beach in Southeast Asia, covered in copper tone, watching B-52s take off on bombing runs. I mean, that's something that just doesn't happen, right, to the normal person. What happened on that? I think it was a Sunday afternoon or something.
These planes were going to Vietnam. They were loaded with bombs. You didn't need to be discerning to figure out that plane was lumbering through the sky in the morning. And we were copper tone, and I don't know, maybe a drink was somewhere there on that beach too. And in the afternoon, planes came back because there was a big military base there. And they just go zipping in because they had delivered their
they were
loads.
Much lighter.
Yeah. And then sometimes at night you'd bump into these American military people in a local bar, and you'd just be looking at them wondering if that was their plane.
Yeah. So you're having this family moment, right, on the beach, and
yeah.
they're at war. They're at combat.
We felt so guilty.
Yeah. You know, another was another overseas moment for you, a little bit different, right, was a weapons depot exploding not far from where you were working. You can talk to us about that moment.
That was a genuinely scary moment. I was visiting one of our stations. I visited that station actually frequently, and there were a couple of incidents. Once I was in a dark room, and I was developing a really sensitive piece of film. And once you start doing that, you can't stop doing it. And our embassy was being attacked by locals. But another time, we were having lunch at the embassy in a restaurant, and all of a sudden, you heard these whistling noises, and it was mortars, it was rockets, it was... And what that was an ammunition dump that we had supplied the local government with weapons to fight the Taliban. And they had it all in this one fortress-like place. And something set it off. It was never really clear what set it off. But all of these armaments detonated at one time and went flying everywhere. We didn't know what to do, so we went low. We went to the basement of that building, and we all huddled in rows along the walls waiting for it to stop. Bunch of people died in that city that day. And then the United States government sent in, is it OSHA? They come in white. They look like white spacesuits. So when you finally look out the window, it's like another planet. It was really a frightening thing.
Yeah, that does not happen to you working in Washington.
It doesn't.
Jana, two more themes. One we started to talk about. So you mentioned you started as a secretary and you worked your way up, right? First to become a technical operations officer, which you talked a little bit about, and eventually to become the agency's chief of disguise. What were you motivated to get ahead, or were you just motivated to do more and more interesting things? What do you think propelled you forward in the agency?
The thing that was always in my mind was to be part of this amazing agency and do the work that needed to be done and help to do something worth doing, to do something that might make a difference, that might actually make a difference. Those two phrases motivated me throughout my career. At the beginning, when I got out of secretarial and into a professional level job, it was photo operations, and that's partly because I was an amateur photographer with a real passion for photography, and they took that and turned me into a person who could do all kinds of things with all kinds of cameras, little tiny cameras, things hidden in buttons, or they're hidden everywhere. And that would have sufficed, except that then my office trained me broadly for a year in all of our capabilities. So audio devices or encrypted communications or everything that we did, how to make a concealment device, how to plaster a wall. I was a jack of all trades. We called it TOPS training. And when you're done with that training, you're like a one-man band. You can walk into a lot of stations to respond to problem A, and while you're there, maybe you can fix problem B and problem C. So I was doing that. I was traveling broadly as a photo operations officer, and I went to the subcontinent for a summer to fill in for someone, and I fell in love with the culture, with the country, with the people, with the food, everything about it. So I went back to D.C. and I talked to my career management officer, who happened to be Tony Mendez at the time.
How about that?
And I said, I would like an assignment. I would like to be assigned there. I'd like to have that be my base that I work out of. He said, there's no job for you there. There's no photo job there. Only thing coming up, he said, is going to be a disguise position in about 18 months. I said, so make me a disguise officer. I'm thinking, how hard can it be? Mm-hmm. Oh. It was so hard, but that's what we did. I switched disciplines in the middle of my career, which is not something I would advise anyone to do necessarily, but I wanted to do that work, and I wanted to do it there, and it was the best decision I ever made. I was happy there.
Yeah, and had a huge impact. So, Jana, one last theme, and this is a theme that is you come back to over and over again in the book, which is being a woman at CIA when it was very much of a man's world, a time defined by gender roles, a time, quite frankly, of gender discrimination. You know, they're not even today where they need to be. Still a work in progress. But what did that world that you walked into feel like? How did you manage it? How did you essentially overcome, you know, and that world to get where you got to?
You know, I think at CIA, the culture, the part of it that I worked in, the technical piece of it, was results driven. They would watch you, and if they thought you could handle this next level of responsibility, they would let you try. And I watched that, and that's what I did. I ended up in a big lab full of men who were like RIT graduates, Rochester Institute of Technology, up shoulder to shoulder with Kodak. They had degrees in photo and all things photo. I had no degree in photography. But at the end of the day, when somebody brought in kind of a mystery roll of film and wanted it developed, but we had no idea what it was, they would give it to me because I was trying harder. I was trying harder because I was trying to compensate for not having that RIT background. So I'd cut little slivers and I developed those. And I never lost a roll of film ever. And they figured, well, she can do that. Okay. They kept giving me more and I kept asking for more. And then there came a point when everybody was away, they were all out on trips. They were doing operations and this thing came up. Who can do that? Well, I could do that. I knew I could do it. And so did my boss. One of the secrets of my career was I had one truly horrible boss and the rest of them were not bad. And some really great ones. His name was Tom. And he said, I think, you know, we'll send you out to handle this operation. And I did. And it was a one of a kind. I was training a man who was going to go back to his home country, a home country none of us could go to. He was going to train his brother in that country how to do microdots, how to do secret writing, how to communicate with us and give us information. It was called a bridge agent. It was the first time I ever heard that term. And it went so well that Christmas, I received a Christmas card from the brother in secret ink. He drew a picture of what he thought maybe a Christmas tree looked like. Mm. He knew me as Jane. Mm. So I put it in the developer in the lab, and I have my white lab coat, and you know, and it comes up, and it's a Christmas tree, and it says, Merry Christmas, Jane. I framed it for the longest time because, I mean, it was innocuous. No one would ever understand but me.
Yeah. So you never felt constrained by this man's world?
Oh, I did. I did. It was not just my supervisors. There was a thought process that the men had, was ingrained in them, this misogynistic. They did it without even thinking about it. Yeah. It was an attitude that was part of the fiber of them. And trying to cut through that was tough because very often they just didn't even realize they were doing it. A lot of women that I knew were a lot madder than I was about this. I was always like, well, you can't blame them. And they were like, oh, yes, you can blame them. I took a course once given by a Marine Corps gunnery sergeant. Was a CIA course, and it was to teach middle and upper grade women how to work with men. But it was a Marine Corps gunny sergeant teaching us about the rules, but it was men's rules he was teaching us. It was it was outrageous. But we took that course, and we learned some stuff along the way. I took a whole lot of training, but there were some just hardcore rules that men were representing. One of them, you would nod your head yes. The DO said women can't work in the field with our foreign assets. That women have no value with these people. They're not going to listen to them. They're not going to take them seriously. And on and on and on. And they believed that. I mean, I think they did believe that. Well, I didn't believe that for a minute.
Yeah, there was somebody else who didn't believe it too. In terms of my reading of the book, right? Tony didn't believe any of that.
That's so interesting about him, because people tend to think of Tony as that Argo guy, the guy who went in and bluffed his way out with these people. So he looked a little tough when Ben Affleck played him. And Tony wasn't, I'm not saying Tony wasn't tough, he was.
Yeah.
But he had an understanding of women at work, and how to help us move forward. Not just me, a whole bunch of women who worked for him would tell you to this day that he was an amazing man to work for. And he was taking care of, they were his people, and he took care of them just like he took care of the men that worked for him.
Yeah, my sense is that he had a big impact on your career when he helped you get to the subcontinent.
That was the beginning of the rest of my career. Actually, it changed my life. Going to the subcontinent. And by the way, my husband was one of those two house husbands I mentioned to you. He wasn't a house husband. He was pretending to be my dependent, but it was my assignment, my tour. You know, that was a little bit unprecedented back then.
So tying up some of these themes, one of the things I thought when I got to the end of the book, Jana, and I think you'll smile at this, was that CIA gave you the two greatest loves of your life, right? Your work and Tony.
I never thought of it that way, but that's absolutely true.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Jonna Mendez.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
So I want to switch gears a little bit, Jonna, and talk about the two specialties that you spent a good part of your career doing. The first, of course, was the clandestine photography that you talked about. What does a specialist in clandestine photography do?
What we do is as broad and as deep as the operation requires. And that was always the beginning. What is the operation? What is the requirement? We did it almost in a military fashion. What is your problem that you're bringing to us? And you think you want a disguise? And maybe it's not a disguise. Maybe you need... Okay, so with the camera, typically, you know, that old meme about a picture is worth a thousand words. It's just so very, very true. We had cameras that ranged from we had cameras in our offices that you could go stand in the camera. They were so big. The field of view was huge. Those were more for printing presses and things. The smallest one we had was the Tropel, where we had a camera in a, if you think of a pen, like a Sharpie, we would have a camera in there, and it would be a film camera because it was back in the day. So there's a cassette inside of a camera, inside of a Sharpie, taking pictures silently with one depression of your finger. That was our best tool, and we only gave it to assets, foreign assets, who could, for instance, get right up to Putin's desk, maybe have a chat with him. Maybe Putin turns his head to ask someone or reach for a phone. Our guy takes the pen and just snaps a photo. Putin turns around, he puts a pen in his pocket, they go to lunch. The intelligence that we got from that camera was just golden. But that's just one piece of it. We were in places we shouldn't be with cameras, taking pictures in the dark without a flash. Well, there was a flash, but we had masked it so you couldn't see the flash. We had cameras in fake pregnancy bellies that some of our women wore proudly. We had cameras everywhere. There wasn't a place you couldn't put a camera. You put it in a button on a coat. And all of those concealed cameras became useful around the world. Then we were doing things like rollover cameras. If you imagine a camera that you could just set down on a desk and roll it over a piece of paper, it would photograph that, and you could get your information that way. We had what we call process cameras, and I think I describe in the book getting stuck in a closet on top of a townhouse in a very hot and humid place and photographing, I don't know, it was like 80 feet of film to collect the intelligence that was in this Soviet weapons manual that this asset was letting us have for an evening. We were just all over the place with photography.
So you tell this particular story where you had to evaluate a package to see whether it had been tampered with or not.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that? It's a remarkable story.
That's also in our photo section. Actually, it was sort of our visual section, so that secret writing microdots were part of our photo operations group. So there was a lot of stuff going back and forth in the mails. We'd be receiving letters to accommodation addresses. Those are fake addresses. We'd collect the mail from there, bring them into the station. And the question would be, has anyone opened this envelope before us? Has anybody else been in this envelope? And we had a variety of ways that we could trap the envelope so that if somebody opened it, we could see it in a laboratory.
What does trap mean?
Well, the trap would be... things that we could put on that letter that would tell us if it had been tampered with. Mm. And that one you're talking about, we had a wax trap on it. And so what that was the flap of the envelope, that side of the envelope, we had taken it's a very special wax, but you just draw a grid. It's invisible. It's wax. It's clear wax on a white paper. You can't see it. You can't even see it shine if you looked at it, but it's there. If somebody opens that envelope, if they steam it, that wax melts and it's not there when you get it. If it's been tampered with by steam, you can see that. But there are other ways into envelopes. There are French openings where you can very carefully slit it on the side or on the bottom. So we'd get out microscopes and we'd look at the fibers. We'd look for fiber tears. We did all of these things. The one in the book that I talked about, there was a chemical called GCR, and we would, at the end of the examination, you would just get a brush and paint the envelope with this clear fluid GCR. And if it had been steamed, again, it would just flash at you this deep mahogany color. And if you saw that, you knew that that envelope had been opened. And then it immediately disappeared.
In this particular case, what happened?
It comes up and it goes away. I went to my boss, whose name was Tom. And I said, Tom, this is, we've got a real strong positive hit on this envelope. And typically, you didn't know all about the operation. I didn't really even know anything about that operation, except it was in Europe. Somebody's been into this envelope. This looks, Tom says, this looks like an insecure communication channel. We'll call our chief of operations, who came from the DO at the time. His name was also Tom. So Tom too comes up to my lab. There's nothing to show them. That's the whole point. It's gone.
Already, yeah.
I said somebody was in the envelope and they had a little powwow and went away. And the consequences of that operation being blown were so huge, but I couldn't know it at the time. I know people were moved out of that country. People, not just a new house, not just a new city, but a new country, to just completely flummox whoever opened the envelope. And we did that daily. We did those things daily.
And that's a tremendous amount of trust in somebody, right? Because the evidence is gone. So they really have to trust you when you're telling them that somebody was in this envelope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all invisible.
Yeah.
It's only visible for a moment.
So, John, the second technical specialty, and you've already touched on this, was operational disguise. What is an operational disguise expert? What does that entail?
Disguise is changing the way that you look for a reason. So you typically, they walk in and say, I need a disguise. And you say, why? And you do a little requirement validation up front, because maybe it's not a disguise. Maybe what they need is something entirely different. But if they convince you that a disguise is what they need, then you find out how will it be used. How close will people be to you? How often will you need to wear it? Where are you going? What's the temperature? What's the weather? You're in an air-conditioned office, right? Just on and on and on, setting out the parameters for what they want. And then you start shaping what might work for them based on that environment that they're going to find themselves in. I was working almost entirely with men because our officers, our operations officers, were almost entirely men back then. By the way, the foreign assets that I worked with were always men. I never worked with a woman who was betraying her government and giving us the information. But back to the men. Well, it's tricky because men don't like to wear wigs. Mm. Men don't want a paste-on mustache. They just don't. And they'll tell you, oh, okay, sure, thank you. I'll put it in this little dop kit and I'll put it in the back of my safe. And if I ever need it, I'll wear it. But you knew they would not. So part of it was the psychology of getting over or around that resistance to make this a viable solution. Tony said he ran disguise for about 10 years. No, 10 years before I did, he was chief of disguise briefly. And it didn't have a wonderful reputation back then. It was just like, oh yeah, you got to go to disguise. They give you a wig and a mustache. And we set out to change that to be more responsive. So we could do anything pretty much to you. If you were going to Moscow, for instance, we would photograph you and measure you and characterize your skin tones and your hair color and your glasses prescription, everything about you, to the extent that we could almost create another you back at headquarters. We could, anything you needed to wear, anything, hair, everything, we could do it without having you present. That was part of it. Then the requirement, in an operational sense, disguise had to be quick. That was always important. It had to be easy and quick. You couldn't, you're not going to have people fussing in front of mirrors. More likely, you're going to have them in a parking garage somewhere in the dark trying to put on their disguise. So we always had that front of mind. That's where the masks started coming in. Because, you know, there you can do a lot of things with a mask. You can actually change the facial structure if that's what you need to do. But a mask can also just be a vehicle that you can attach the wig to, maybe a beard. It's made just for you. It custom fits you and no one else. So you could sit in a car in a parking garage and just put this thing on and settle it on your face and everything else would be in the right place. You didn't need a mirror. Once you had the mask on and it registered, you could get out of the car and walk into a public space and not worry about it. So it was very flexible. But those masks, only the bottom half of them animated. This was rigid. The chin, the mouth, it was your chin and your mouth. And then we eventually took it further. We made full face animated masks that were amazing.
Johnny, you tell the story in the book of helping a Soviet defector to get out of Afghanistan. Can you talk about that?
The cases, getting people out of various countries, that's exfiltration. That was Tony Mendez's claim to fame, kind of, that he was able to help in a number of those operations. We had gone up to the border into Peshawar, and we were wondering how we would move a Russian. If we had a Russian walk in, a walk in was more common than people would think.
And this was during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
What if one of them decides they want to come out and work with the West for whatever reason? And so we're going around trying to figure out how to move a Russian out of Afghanistan into Pakistan at the time. And we came up with a number of scenarios. One of them was the burqa. The burqa scenario was always good because you never knew what was under a burqa. It could be a man or a woman. It could be a soldier or a young girl. It could be, but the rules of the road back then were you couldn't look, you couldn't peek. You actually couldn't even engage in a conversation. So if there was a truck with a driver and a woman in a burqa, and a woman maybe in a burqa next to him, the border guard cannot challenge the woman in the burqa. So we thought that would be one way to do it. We came up with another way to get someone out. We had gone out to Hollywood and worked with them, with the magic community closely. Tony had pioneered the way working with makeup in Hollywood. Then we went another direction because we were very interested in the idea of deception and illusion, because that was sort of our business model as well as their business model. In terms of how to get somebody out of Afghanistan, we came up with a dolly. A dolly is something that warehouse people move boxes around with. They move everything around with. They move cases of water. They move refrigerators. You put it on the dolly, you wheel it in, you wheel it out. And we came up with a dolly that was full of cases of water that would actually conceal a person. And the weight of the person was roughly equivalent to the weight of, say, three cases of water. And we had it positioned just waiting for someone to come and ask for our help.
Amazing.
You had to get ahead of things.
Yeah. You got to be ready.
You have to be ready. It's like Baden Powell. That was his motto for the Boy Scouts, right?
And then you did something else when you were chief of disguise. You went to the Oval Office.
I did that. that was really not on the agenda. That was when we were we were putting together the fully animated mask. And I have to say, we had some technical people working on that for years. We had an outside contractor, and we had our inside, our best disguise person. The two of them kept looking for materials and kept testing stuff. You know, something that would, was the animation was the difficulty. And they pretty much figured out how to do it. And so as chief of disguise, I got to wear one of the first ones, and I put it on. It turned me into an African-American man. I put on a man's suit, and I went down to meet with our the chief of our office. His name was Frank Anderson. He was very forward-looking chief, and he just loved it. He thought it was, he knew we were trying to do it, but he hadn't heard anything for a while. I think he thought, well, maybe they discarded it. And there we were in the office, and he said, this is just so good that we've got to take it to Judge Webster. So we did. We took it to Judge Webster, who was then the head of the CIA. And he liked it even more than Frank Anderson. He was just, they were like kids, like, this is great. And Judge Webster said, we're going to take it to the White House. And then I think Frank Anderson kind of chimed in too. I was like, eh. You know, the Secret Service is, they'll let you get away with this and that. But I don't know that we can fool them. I don't walk like a man. I don't talk like a man. And we decided that we'd make another mask, not an African-American man, but just a quite a different looking female. So I was blonde back then. So this new mask had black curly hair, kind of a Latina vibe. And I went to Webster's house because I drove drove with his drivers to the CIA and then to the White House. And we got to the White House. I had no documentation at all. This is before things got really tricky. I said, how will I get in? I don't have any ID. He said, don't worry about it. You just stick with me, which I did. Worked fine. And then we had to wait. They were going long in the Oval Office, and then they came out, and we went in, and there's this horseshoe of chairs in front of the president's desk, and it was George H.W. And I sat far right because I was the first one to brief, and then I would be the first one to leave. So we're doing that. And I had taken a folder of pictures of George H.W. Bush when he was head of CIA. He had been the director. And we had done some disguises for him. I said, you might remember these, sir. And like anyone looking back at themselves in wigs, and he was like, oh, yeah, that was great. That was fun. And I saw this president kind of really enjoy himself just then. I'd always seen this kind of grim president. I just thought he didn't have a sense of humor. I was wrong. So I said, well, I'm here to show you the next new thing that we have, and I think you'll like it. And he's looking like, well, where is it? He's looking for a bag or stuff. I said, well, I'm wearing it, and I'm going to take it off and let you admire it. And I go to do the Tom Cruise peel, which was way before Tom Cruise did it. Mm-hmm. And he said, stop, no, don't take it off. He still didn't know what it was. So he got up and he walked around and he looked and he's looking. I know what he's looking for. He's looking for edges. He's looking for seams. He's looking for telltale. Couldn't see anything. He sat down. He said, okay, take it off. So I did that. And I'm holding it up so he can see. It's just, I'm spinning it a little bit. It's light. The hair is all attached. I didn't mention that it's a very pretty mask. It was a lady who worked for me. She was leaving. She gave me her face. And we always said, we in disguise, we never promise that we'll make you look better. But this did make me look better. I wanted to keep it. I liked the hair. I liked the makeup. Mm-hmm. So Bush just sparkled. If he had done that when he was running the second time, he would have gotten a lot more of a vote. He was loving it. So he thanked me very much. And I went out to the office. There was that dog, Millie, and her puppies. And I'm playing with the puppies, and somebody comes out behind me, and I didn't even look up. It was a woman, and she said it was the photographer who took the pictures. There were pictures of all of this. And she said, what was that you did? And I said, I said, you took a picture, because I heard the shutter. She said, yeah, but what was that? And I said, well, I can't say, because it's classified. And I think I ticked her off. It took 10 years for that picture to reach me. And when I got it, they had airbrushed the mask out of my hand. So the picture that used to hang in here in the office has a picture of me. It looks like I'm pointing at him saying, and you, sir, should consider this idea I have. It looks like I'm lecturing the president. It's a funny picture. All my friends would come in and say, that's you, right? That's me. What were you saying to him? And I say,
you were holding the mask.
Yeah. I say, well, I can't tell you. It's classified.
Yeah, that's great. The book is In True Face, A Woman's Life in CIA Unmasked, and the author is Jonna Mendez. Jonna, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I love it.
That was Jonna Mendez. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.